are listening to a podcast of The View, brought to you by the Church of the Larger Fellowship. To subscribe to this podcast, visit questformeaning.org or search for Church of the Larger Fellowship in the iTunes Store.
Hello, good morning. This is Meg Riley, and it's going to be 39 today, Minneapolis. We've had, like many people, these wild swings. It was 15 below. It's going to be 40 above. They're doing pond hockey at the lake down the street, and I'm thinking they're going to be wading around by Sunday because it's going to be above freezing. Anyway, hello. Welcome to The View. How about a regular say hello?
Hi, I'm Aisha Hauser in Seattle, Washington.
Good morning, everyone. This is Michael Tino in Peekskill, New York.
We're going to be joined by Carlton Elliott Smith from Mississippi, who's having some tech problems with our lovely platform, Google on the Air. Oh, there he is. Hello, Carlton.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah, just great. Good. I was saying, you know, politicians, they always make an entrance.
Okay, let's start there.
Let's start there.
My father was actually mayor of my hometown for 12 years. First Black mayor, actually was the first Black alderman going back to 1977. And he never identified as a politician. And I join in that vein. He was always an elected official, and I'm a person seeking elected office. When I think of politician, I think of someone who's looking for some way of increasing their own fortune through manipulating the people. And I'm not, you know, I don't consider myself in that category.
Well, so. Amen. There you go. You're a Unitarian Universalist minister seeking political office.
That's correct.
And that's what we wanted to talk to you about. You know, we are a church. We're not going to say we endorse you for Congress.
That would be crossing the line of the church.
That would be crossing a line, and we don't cross it. But we're really just excited that you're in Mississippi running for office, and we just want to hear about it. So let's just start with how you decided to do that.
Well, it was in a period in my life this is going back to last summer, when I was in a time of discernment, trying to figure out what my next steps in my life were going to be. It had been a very tumultuous year in our Unitarian Universalist Association already. And I was wondering, you know, what might be possible in terms of like what direction my life might take from that point going forward. And it was in a conversation with some beloved, trusted colleagues in the Southern region that this emerged as a possibility. And from that, the members of the team were very enthusiastic in their support. And I just began to look at it more seriously. And began to do what was necessary through contacts in the Southern region to figure out how to move that forward. And that's how it came to be. And so really, at the moment it presented itself as a possibility, I had a similar experience to what I had when I had my sense of call into the ministry, which was an opportunity to be of service, an opportunity to contribute, an opportunity to make a difference. And so that's really the crux of it. Yeah, and I think especially in this time when things are just in such upheaval nationally, that to have some voices in the room that are representing a sense of compassion, a sense of commitment to what's in the best interest of as many people as possible, that felt like a worthwhile endeavor to me.
So if your dad, you know, you know how vicious this stuff can get. And so you clearly... I'm sure, so can ministry, let's be real. So can life and God.
You took the words right out of my mouth. I think ministry is wonderful preparation for people who, or congregational life for that matter, is wonderful preparation for people seeking elected office, because you have there's always different motivations that are happening and operating under the table, different sources of power, some of them based on money, some of them based on influence. And so all of that is in the mix as well. So I feel very well prepared for the road ahead through the training and development that I've gotten through working with congregations over many years.
That is really interesting. Intuitively, absolutely true to me. What other skills do you feel like from the ministry or from congregational life really have helped you now?
A lot of it has to do with just the capacity to listen. I think that listen and learn, and being willing to learn from one's mistakes. Certainly, you know, over the course of, you know, more than 20 years of ministry, I've had my opportunities to fumble, to slip up, to misunderstand, to be misunderstood. And through it all, I think what's been consistent is the ability to recognize and learn and grow from those many experiences. So I'd say that that is one thing that's been helpful. In congregational life, I'm in the process now of preparing to go on a leave from my work with our association and part of the congregational life here in the Southern region. When I was first coming on the staff, one of the important things to do was to be able to get out and meet people at those many local congregations that I was primary contact for. So I was out in Tennessee and Mississippi, Alabama, Louisiana, Arkansas, Florida, and even further afield than that. Just getting to know the people out in the communities, those different communities, those different congregations, and finding out what their needs were and how we might be able to help and support them as an association. So I think that that is an important skill. Of course, being accustomed to being in front of groups of people is a definite asset. And I've had a chance to do that for many years. And having a sense of what is inspiring and what can be inspiring and how people can learn and grow together is also an asset. But go ahead. No, I was going to say, and then, you know, in this week that we're celebrating the life of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., I think also a commitment to justice and a commitment to love and a belief that we can transform society through nonviolent means, which is quite different from many of the options that are being presented both verbally and nonverbally. You know, being at the Unite the Right rally as part of that counter protest in Charlottesville, you know, certainly was an example of those of us, including our association president, Susan Frederick Gray, stepping forward with a nonviolent, peaceful message and alternative.
So I'm curious, as you talk to people in Mississippi, what you are hearing, and also can you describe your district a little bit for us?
Sure. Gladly. The district is the north and northwest of Mississippi, so it stretches all the way from the western corner, which are the Mississippi suburbs of Memphis, Tennessee, all across the Mississippi-Tennessee border, halfway down the Alabama-Mississippi border, and then it zigzags back up towards those Mississippi suburbs of Memphis. That's 22 counties, 22 and a half, actually, because one of them is partially in the district. It includes the towns of Oxford, Mississippi, which is where Ole Miss is. Those Memphis suburbs include Olive Branch, Hernando, South Haven, Tupelo, Mississippi, which people have heard of, which is the birthplace of Elvis Presley, very well known for that, and some of the communities surrounding Mississippi State. So it's quite a large area. And I'm looking forward to getting out and having even more encounters with those folks as we go along. Oh, I should also say in the middle of that is my hometown, which is Holly Springs, Mississippi, which is where I'm with you from now, which is in Marshall County.
So you're in the middle of it.
I mean, the interesting thing is that I drove to a holiday party over the break and went to catch up with some friends down in Webster County, which was almost like a 2-hour drive. So I'm still in the district. So that gives you a sense of how spread out it is. And the people in the district, what I'm hearing people are concerned about are things that people are concerned about everywhere at this point. It has to do with access to healthcare. It has to do with job opportunities and educational opportunities for our young people as well. And I would say that, you know, in this current political climate in which we find ourselves, where there's just so much that's at stake, I feel that our best opportunity for making a difference now is to pay attention to these elections this year, the 2018 midterm, and to use it as an opportunity to send a message that the people are not going to sit idly by while one of the parties continues to do a smash and grab with regards to the national treasuries and our national resources, that we must preserve these We're not trying to move back to previous centuries where we have second classes of people, that all people should be represented and all people should have access to the basic needs and necessities of life. And I don't think that's too much to ask.
Is the seat now in Republican hands and you're running as a Democrat?
Yes, I am running as a Democrat. There is another Democratic nominee, another Democratic candidate as well, whom I've had a chance to meet on a couple of occasions. The primary is June 5th. And then based on the outcome of that, one or the other of us will be on the ballot for the general election on November 6th, which, as it turns out, is the day before my 54th birthday. So it will be like quite, I would love to wake up in Congress on my birthday on the morning of November 7th.
Hey, Michelle Obama just turned 54 yesterday.
Well, there you go. I often think that if we had all lived in the same town, we would have all been in high school together. So it's funny to ponder that.
Wow.
So as you described this district, Carlton, it seems like it's a lot of small cities and then Memphis suburbs. And, you know, I grew up in a big city, but I live in a small town now. And even though it's a suburb, it functions very relationally. And so I guess your dad was the mayor. Mm-hmm. You're probably used to how things function relationally. Is that something that you also bring from the ministry into this?
Definitely. The commitment to building and maintaining strong relationships is going to be essential to the success of it, which is why I'm really excited for this tour that I'm planning of all of the counties in the district, where I'll be, you know, getting out on a regular basis between now and the primary, and then even after the, well, presumably after the primary, fingers crossed, or going to do the work around that to make it so. So that I can build those relationships. And some of those relationships are already in place. Of course, here in Marshall County, I've been known here for, you know, since I was a child. This is where I was raised and born. And of course, Mississippi being the kind of having the population density that it has, which is relatively low, there's always people who know people in the next county and different organizations that have roots and are spread throughout. I had a chance to speak recently at the NAACP Martin Luther King breakfast just a few days ago. For the Marshall County chapter where I am, but there are also other NAACP chapters, of course, throughout the district, and I'm looking forward to connecting with those folks as well. Hopefully facilitating some of the organization for the Democratic Party that's going to be necessary. That's one of the challenges, I think, that we faced in the state of Mississippi and in the South in general, and perhaps in other more rural parts of the country as well, as that the Democrats have been challenged around organization. And so I'm hoping to be able to put some of that in place as part of my campaign. So the relationship is terrifically important.
Ministers complain about candidating week and how exhausting it is. Mm-hmm. And you're looking at candidating months and months, right? So if you go to one of these other counties, what do you do there? Like, what's a day look like? Or what do you, once you're not also... I know right now you're also working for Congregational Life, and I'm sure your days are very full, but what do you envision for your tour? Like, are you going to go door to door and talk to individuals? You can go to shopping malls and kiss babies. What are you going to do?
It's going to be all of the above and more. The interesting thing that I've come to own and acknowledge over the course of the past several weeks is that different from being a minister, when you step out the door and, you know, there might be people from your congregation who recognize you in the grocery store. When I step out the door now, I'm always surrounded by potential constituents, by potential voters, by potential donors. And so that's something that's in my mind now. And I'm finding that it's going to require like a shift to a different consciousness. It's already underway, let me put it that way, to be able to be in that awareness and to make the most of each of the opportunities I have to share my vision with the folks here in the state of Mississippi.
So I'm curious. I'm sorry. You want me? Okay. How, if at all, has your identity as a Black gay man entered into the paradigm or consciousness? Because it is Mississippi, and that was the first thing I thought. I'm like, oh, yay, Carlton, and wow, Carlton. So I would love to hear if that has all at all, if anybody's been said anything about that.
Yeah, at the moment, it's something that is certainly in my consciousness. I think relative to the issues that are most important to the folks in Mississippi, as I mentioned before, which have to do with education, health care, and employment opportunities, those things, are a bit, there's not all of that much overlap. I mean, well, I guess it could be depending on, you know, whether or not you're fired from your job because you're LGBTQ. Of course, we acknowledge, you know, that as a possibility. And at the same time, I'm looking to focus primarily on those issues that are central and important to all Mississippians. And in terms of anything that has to do with my personal life, my belief is, well, two things. One is that being gay identified, being a Black person, I think that that gives me a certain level of empathy and understanding for people who are used to being marginalized, used to not being believed, used to be having their voices discounted. So I would say from that standpoint, I am feeling empowered in a certain way. Then also, I think I've got the possibility of extending and reaching out to more people on that basis as well. And I guess the other thing that I'm aware of in the midst of this is that we have people serving in the highest levels of government who are confessed aggressors towards women, for example. Let's just take that for example. And people proudly voted for such candidates and support such candidates. We can see what happened in the state of Alabama right next door with Roy Moore and everything that went on with that. And so I feel like, if anything, at this point, that people should not feel deterred from campaigning for political office because they don't fit the stereotypical profile of what people expect from a candidate. Certainly we've got people serving in very high offices now who don't fit the stereotypical profile of what people expect. So I said yes to myself and I saw the possibility to contribute. And so that's what I'm following with and what I'm flowing with. And one of the things that I am aware of is just the need for more diverse representation in government as well, because I think part of the reason things are so difficult is that some people are only used to seeing certain people in those roles and in those positions of leadership. And I think we're going to benefit and support the country much more as we're able to show that there are many people who have the capacity to step into those leadership roles.
I have so many questions. I mean, I'm so excited that you're doing this, and I'm hoping this show is making other people say, wow, like Aisha, you know, wow, maybe I should do that too. You know, like I feel like what you say, that it really is so exciting to see the people stepping forward who maybe wouldn't have stepped forward 4 years ago, you know? And so I have so many questions for you. One is money. I mean, money is so much part of politics. And even though you're not a politician, you are running for elected office.
I am running for elected office. That's
money
for sure.
Is a critical piece of that. So in Mississippi, right now, you don't have, you know, the Republican influx of money. But at least here, the more progressive candidates are not particularly supported by the Democratic Party either. Often they support the kind of stodgy traditional candidates. So I wonder how it is with money, how much money you feel like you need to have to run for the office that you're running for, and, you know, and how that is for you, because certainly that's part of ministry, but it's a huge part of running for office.
Yes, money is going to be a critical factor to the success of the campaign. And fortunately, over the course of years of being in ministry and being in other situations of leadership where I've been required to, or I've been called to, invite people to be generous contributors and generous donors, it will be a factor that's very important. And I feel equipped to be able to address people in those ways. In terms of the campaign, I'm thinking, just looking at like what the spending pattern was for previous campaigns, it will probably be a 6 to 7 figure amount that would be necessary to have a successful run and to get the word out there and elevate my profile to that level. And so I'm working with people both locally and further afield and have gotten, you know, tremendous support from people in other states as well. I was just doing some calculations last night about contributions and support from fellow Unitarian Universalist ministers. There's been support from Unitarian Universalist General, but just looking at the ministers who contributed, and that's been very solid and very encouraging. So, yes, for anyone who wants to contribute, I certainly welcome that from everyone within the borders of the United States. Of course, you can't do that internationally, but within the borders of the country, yes, it's most welcome. Yeah.
Yes, you did. But I wonder about the Democratic Party there. Here, you know, we just elected 3 new Black people to city council. 2 of them are transgender. It was so exciting. I can't really say the DFL here had much to do with it at all. As I watched, it was great organizing. One of them the DFL supported because she wasn't contested by another white person. But I'm just curious, you know, how, if you're just running your own campaign and kind of letting that take its course, is the Democratic Party supporting your opposition or neither of you, or how is that?
Yeah, I certainly haven't gotten any support yet from the Democratic Party on any level at this point, which I wouldn't expect. I think that the plan is that everybody just kind of sits back and waits to see like what the outcome of the primary is going to be, and then there starts to be more momentum behind whoever the winner of that is, which makes sense to me, you know, on a certain level, because on the primary level. It's like whatever you give, you'd have to give the same amount to the other person anyway. So, which cancels it all out when you could just save it for the general election. So I understand that. Yes, I'll be able to say more about that on the other side of the primary.
And so Aisha mentioned a couple of your identities. I wonder about your identity as a Unitarian Universalist minister and if that's come up at all for anybody. And how that goes, both the minister in general part and then the Unitarian Universalist part.
I am excited to be connecting with ministerial colleagues here who have been supportive as well, and across different faith traditions. So I appreciate that. My roots are in the United Methodist Church, so there's a natural affinity for me with United Methodist for sure. Though at the same time, depending on which congregation you're a part of, there are reasons. There's some that are, you know, much more conservative than others. For those that can see the connection and the commonality between challenges that people face, I'm grateful for those as well. Unitarian Universalism isn't very well known in Mississippi. So as I'm talking about, as I'm going about connecting with folks, I'm trying to help people understand a bit about like what the tradition is. I was just speaking the other day about being a Unitarian Universalist minister to the folks at this NAACP MLK breakfast, and was talking about it particularly in terms of being very much on the leading edge of social justice causes, going all the way back to the abolition of slavery and women's right to vote and reproductive choices and up through the civil rights era, immigration, LGBTQ issues. So I think being able to locate Unitarian Universalism in that context and with a deep commitment to justice and love and compassion, that people are able to understand and relate to that. But the number of Unitarian Universalist congregations in the actual district itself is very small. There's one in Oxford and one in Tupelo, and that's it. But
those are small liberal places in, right? I know Oxford's a more liberal place. Is Tupelo as well?
Tupelo, I would say, is probably not as liberal as Oxford. It's more, it has more of sort of like a kind of, for lack of a better term, a kind of blue collar ethic, I think I would understand. So, and it doesn't have like a major university in the middle of it, but it has been very attractive because they have a strong public school system, and industry finds that attractive as well. So, yeah, but I would say that Oxford is probably, of the towns, probably one of the most liberal in the state. And then, of course, as you're in a more kind of urban setting where there are more people, more different kinds of people interacting with each other, such as in the suburbs of Memphis, you have a bit more, I'd say a bit more of a liberal slant there as well.
So Jackson isn't in your district?
No, Jackson is in District 3.
Because that's a very progressive place. I mean, mm-hmm. Historically, I'm just thinking, you know, I drove to GA this year through Memphis and then down through Mississippi. So I probably saw a lot of your district without knowing it. And I think this also wasn't in your district because it's over by Jackson, but it must impact. There was the most giant Nissan plant I've ever seen in my life, right? I mean, it went.
Yeah,
I
in Canton, which is just north of Jackson. I was actually down there during the course of the summer because they had been trying to, there's been an activity they're trying to unionize for many years, and they had a vote this summer on that, in which the folks who didn't want to unionize had more votes than the people who did. So it's an ongoing struggle, I'd say, in the state. And I understand, I respect the workers' rights to determine how they want, if they want to organize or not. The concern that I have generally around those issues are that people should be able to cast their votes in that direction without any coercion. And some accounts say that there were occasions where people felt pressured to vote against unionization, and I think that's not right. And the other thing I would say too is, we know, I mean, from our unions, there's been so much progress made in terms of labor laws in our country too. And I think there's a way in which, if we're not careful, that we could see some erosion around all of that, to the extent that the workers aren't well represented in the negotiating process.
Yeah. In that way, Mississippi is no different from Minnesota or many other places, right? I mean,
yeah.
But so I'm curious, I mean, obviously thousands of people must work there, but what are the other big employers? And in your district, where do people work mostly? What do they do?
You know, a lot of the work, I was looking at a map not that long ago of what the biggest employers were in each state. And Mississippi is one of those states where Walmart is like the largest employer, you know, in the area. So we've got lots of retail opportunities and retail outlets. And in towns like Oxford, you know, where you've got a college, there's lots of businesses, lots of employment that's tied into that one way or the other. And Memphis being one of the big distribution centers of the country, with Federal Express being based there, and many, it's the crossroads of many distribution systems. There's a lot of employment in that area as well. People would think that there's a lot of farming, a lot of people who are employed in farming or agriculture, but with the advances in technology, it's a relatively small sector of the economy.
You mean with agribusiness and giant machines? Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it advances, but yeah.
Right, yeah. Right.
A lot of cotton driving through Mississippi fields, which I didn't know were still there. I mean, I guess machines must do that work now, I hope.
Yeah,
I hope.
For sure.
That's a mean crop, that one. So I'm curious, you know, I mean, and this is, again, this is not to say Mississippi, because Minnesota's, all the markers here about racial divides could be Mississippi. I mean, they're horrible in Minnesota. So I'm not one of those people who's like, oh, thank God I don't live in the South. I grew up there. I love the South. And the racial divides are very real in Mississippi because we're always compared to Mississippi. So I'm kind of familiar with them because it's usually like we are just like Mississippi here with these divides in every marker you've got, employment, transportation, health, all of it. Are you talking about that in your campaign? Are you aiming? I mean, obviously you're very progressive. Are you just tailoring it to who you speak to? Or do you see a general public interest in that? Clearly in Alabama, it was the black vote that defeated Roy Moore. Is part of your strategy to really up who turns out to vote? Like, how are you thinking about race and racism and all of this?
I am certain that the outcome of the vote, if it's going to be favorable for me or the other Democratic candidate, is going to have a lot to do with high voter turnout. And so I'm very much committed to supporting those efforts. There is a relatively new group that's gotten started in the past couple of years called Mississippi Votes, which has been a lot of young adults, actually, and young college students across the state who have started to organize to get people registered. I went to a fundraiser for them not that long ago that was really exciting to see what they're doing and what their commitment is. They're nonpartisan, which I think is great, but I know that if we're going to make a difference, there's going to have to be a way of engaging and inspiring people who otherwise would feel like they don't have a stake in the process and that it's, you know, quote unquote, rigged such that their votes won't make a difference if they don't count. But I would say certainly, you know, again, as we saw in Alabama, that every vote counts. Yes. And it's, I mean, in so much in Mississippi and in other states is determined by, you know, where one stands on or one's social location relative to race and ethnicity. And some people vote strictly according to those lines. The district that I'm in is about 27% black and 70% white, the way that it's set up. So it would not be possible to win for a candidate such as me to win an election based on strictly on a racial demographic. I think there's a way of affirming and appreciating the amazing contributions of black people and black voters. And as we saw in Alabama, just the steadfastness of the black women voters in particular, acknowledging and affirming all of that. And at the same time, recognizing that the district is made up of more than just black people, that there are people from all kinds of different backgrounds and stripes. And I think to the extent that we're going to be able to make a valid case to people, regardless of their race or ethnicity, about why we need change in our government, about how we're not being served well by the incumbent, who 93% of the time has voted in line with the current administration in the White House, that if we're able to help people understand how their best interests can be served, not by following a candidate just based on who they are in terms of their ethnicity or their gender, but in terms of how they're actually going to vote and care for their people through voting consistent with what's in the people's best interest, I think that will give us a shot at having success.
So I'm wondering, you know, I've done some homework because we knew we were having you on, and I saw that, you know, your district, the first district of Mississippi, is rated a fairly strongly Republican leaning district. A generic Republican is given a 16 point edge there by Cook, and the incumbent won re-election in 2016 by 40 points, right? So 68-28. I'm wondering. So what I really would love to hear you reflect about is what it's like going into this with that reality, in just facing that reality and really, and this is your home, right? Mm-hmm. You're up here. So this is where you're from, and this is who you are called to serve in elected office. What's it like facing that that hill, that really steep hill in front of you. Because I have no doubt that you can climb it, but I just want to know what it's like.
It is. I find it energizing. You know, I can't speak to, you know, the particular dynamics that or what other previous Democratic candidates brought to the table. And again, I think that it has something to do with paying attention to setting up a great infrastructure, encouraging and promoting voter turnout. I can think of any number of times I've been in situations inside of our association, inside of congregations, where I've wondered, you know, what the prospect for quote unquote success would be, and dared to believe. Campaign slogan, daring to believe that there's something else is possible. If we even look at something as basic as, you know, Barack Obama's candidacy and presidency, it's like that was unlike Hillary's going up against Hillary Clinton. That was quite improbable, but it just goes to show that there was a moment in time, a window of opportunity that was opened, and he was able to prove himself to be a viable candidate. Not that I'm putting myself on the level of a Barack Obama, mind you, but I will say that I feel like we're in a similar moment in history now, where across the country, we've already started to see it, that people are beginning to say, wait a minute, it's like we don't approve, we don't appreciate where things are going, we don't have enough checks and balances inside of our government now, and this midterm election is an opportunity to put those checks and balances in place and to resist the tide that would dominate in perpetuity every single branch of the government, and not for the benefit of the people, but for the wealthiest individuals in the country and the wealthy corporations. So all that to say is I'm feeling energized. I'm feeling inspired. I feel like the message that we're presenting is a strong one, and that that the people will be able to hear it for what it is. And in terms of like what the outcome of the election is, it will be what it will be, but I think that we've got the tools and the resources and the energy and the momentum necessary to prevail.
Do you feel like the wave of resistance to the policies of our current administration is kind of like a wind at your back pushing you? I mean, do you actually gain energy from just thinking about all the people who are just saying no to what's going on right now?
Okay, I feel two ways about that. One, I feel I do feel that there's a certain amount of energy with that, that people are wanting to do something different, that people are wanting a different kind of representation in our national government. And I appreciate and value that. And then on the other hand, I don't want our campaign to just be about that. I really want it to be about something that is positive and that's life-affirming and life-giving. So yes, I appreciate the fact that people want something different, and I want something different myself, but it's not about difference just for difference sake. It's really about going back to the deepest values that we hold as Mississippians, as people in the country in general, and how do we get back to being a society that is open-hearted and looks out for its own and make sure that everyone has the health care that they need, that our children are well-educated, that people have the employment opportunities that benefit them. So I think to the extent that we can put all of those things in place, it's going to support us.
I see you as a transformed person. You are so focused. You are so on message. clearly your whole heart, soul, and being is in this. And who's supporting you there? Do you have like a really good team of people who are helping you do this? I'm just seeing so much strength in you. And I'm like, wow.
Yeah, I'm so grateful for the support that I've received so far. Unitarian Universalists in general, Unitarian Universalist ministerial colleagues have been tremendously supportive here in the state. in Marshall County, I've gotten tremendous support from the fellow citizens and constituents here, which I'm very, very grateful for. And that's extended outward. As I've gone to meetings of the Mississippi Municipal League, I'm encountering people who are enthusiastic. As I go to different conferences, I'm also receiving a very warm reception there. And in terms of team support, that team is in the process of coming together. It's interesting. I've been dealing with some very pressing issues in my family in the latter part of the year. So I just kind of had to put the campaign a little bit in second place while I, you know, address that. But now, now that I'm about to go on leave for my work with the UUA, and we've got, you know, this, you know, really quite tight window between now and the primary, I'm very grateful for the people who have emerged and who've been very supportive. And so we're going to start to have like regular meetings around that. But it's been people who were colleagues of my father in different political and civic activities and on the campus of Rust College in the past. When I needed to identify a treasurer, it was the one of the members of the finance committee of the church that I grew up in that I said, I'm going to call Dr. Scott. Dr. Scott would be great at this. And so he stepped up very graciously, and we identified the accountant who's working with us to keep track of everything and make sure everything goes well. So yes, it's coming together. And some of those, you know, who are going to be on the steering committee are going to be Unitarian Universalist here in the district as well. So I'm very, very grateful for that.
And are you wanting people to come there at some point to help leaflet, or I mean, are you going to do a call out, or is it counterproductive to have people come in from other places there?
I think there are opportunities. For people who have been asking, I've been saying, well, let's see, the primary is going to be on June 5th, and so I'm thinking if people were able to come and be part of those leafleting efforts in different counties, starting from like the Thursday or Friday before, that would be wonderful. I think it's also going to be great to have people down here who are able to give people rides to get to the polls, because I don't think transportation is going to be easy for everyone, and we certainly want to have that base covered. It shouldn't be the case that anybody doesn't vote because they weren't able to get a ride to the poll. I'm personally committed to helping that not be the case. But yeah, I think it would be wonderful to have people come down, you know, right around that weekend. And there might be some other opportunities before that as we're going door to door. I was just thinking, going back to your question from earlier about what it was gonna look like, or what I imagined it looked like once I'm out in the counties. And it's gonna be going to those restaurants where people are just hanging out and having breakfast and having conversations with them, and going to the different congregations and being with them on Sunday mornings and for their after school programs and having a chance to interact with them there. I know that there's one minister in the district who's done some tremendous work about making sure that people have getting the word out about the Affordable Care Act and his members that need to register for that. And also went as far as to take fried chicken off of the church menu. So they don't have any events that have fried chicken anymore because it's a health concern, which, you know, I appreciate, and I think that's a real bold stance for a minister to take. So connecting with people like that as well, plus you know, being very much open to other speaking opportunities at different civic organizations. So it's going to be a very very intense and exciting and outward focused time.
I was going to ask you if there was anything that surprised you about the process, but then you said about the fried chicken, but that has nothing to do with your process, but I was surprised. but how did you find it challenging, easy, difficult to even get in? Were there unusual barriers you had to cross? I don't know about here. I've never run for public office. Do you need 200 signatures? Do you need 3,000 signatures? Do you need any signatures? So I'd love to know a little bit about that process.
Yeah, the person who was so instrumental to me in terms of getting my process together is actually the husband of one of my colleagues on the Southern Region team. His name is Sean Briscoe, and he's a political consultant in Texas. And it was it was he who told me how to go about the process. You go to the Federal Elections Commission. There are forms that you fill out there. No, you don't need signatures to register to be a candidate for federal office. I'm just trying to think about the things that are necessary to have a bank account, to be able to receive funds. You've got to have a treasurer, got to have a mailbox address where people, or an address that people can send things to. It was important to set up a website relatively soon, and also to have a way of people to make online donations. And then, of course, setting up the different social media platforms. And I had a number of those in place already, but I got a specific Facebook page. But really, I mean, in terms of just being registered, it's not that hard. At least for running for Congress was my experience. I'd say that in terms of like just the actual, I mean, from the time that I, you know, got clear that I was running to the time that I actually could go to like go to a website online and see that I was listed as one of the candidates for Mississippi's first district, it was 7 days. To get all of those things in place. So no, it's not difficult. I didn't think it was difficult at all.
Interesting. So I wonder if the signature thing is a local, school board, or I know there's a local thing. So it's good to hear at least federal. You don't need to run around and get thousands of signatures.
No.
Signatures locally, because we have ranked choice voting. Do you? And before we had signatures, we had like so many people running for mayor, it was a joke. And so at least making people come through some window, I was really grateful they did it, truthfully.
Yeah, and we, and I know that for different elections that we've had here, we recently had like a state senator election that was for two counties, Marshall County and Tate County, which is a county next door. And there ended up being five candidates running for that position, and none of those candidates had over 50% of the vote coming out of that. So then they narrowed it down to the last two. But they were four people who were registered as Democrats, and one who was like undetermined during the election, who came out as a Republican afterwards. So that was there's some feelings around that in the 10th state Senate district.
That makes me wonder. Starting by, you know, a lot of people start with, you know, county school board or, you know, I mean, start small. And I mean, you're going right for federal office. Was that just part of the call? Like you were like, because I have to say, Congress looks like a pretty tough place to go every day to me. So you'd have to be called there to want to go wrestle what's going on there with the gridlock and everything. Was your call felt really specific to this position, this election?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I was the thing that was brought to my attention in conversations with people whom I found, you know, very helpful is that I actually did, and I guess I would say even looking at my engagement in our Unitarian Universalist Association, my engagement in different activities over the past two or three years has really had me look very intently at you know, or to take greater responsibility for my capacity for leadership and for the network of people that I've had the blessing to engage with over the years, and the social capital that I have that's again not just limited to a specific geographical location, but actually extends, you know, quite far and quite wide. So from that standpoint, I did feel that I did have like a strong possibility for running for Congress. The Senate level, that felt like, you know, over and beyond. That felt like a bit too much, but I did feel that serving on the congressional level was within reach.
I feel so proud to know you. I mean, I just, you know, that's such a big... That's probably a lot of people are feeling pulls, but you heard it and you responded, and it's just really moving to hear about and to see in action. And to me, you know, when Michael brings up those statistics, I think, well, you know, what Evan Wolfson always said about marriage equality, lose forward. So you don't, you know, say you don't get in this time, you've got a whole lot of relationships built, you've got name recognition, you know, I mean, it's I hope that you're looking at this, you know, in terms of kind of what you're called to do. I mean, we'll see.
I'm curious at something you said in the very beginning, that the events of what was going on at the UUA kind of had you think differently. So I'm curious if you feel comfortable speaking about that, because I'm just curious as to, are you talking about the white supremacy stuff and how that led you to make this connection?
Yeah. I would say that, you know, just looking at my engagement in some of those activities and looking to see how I might be able to contribute by helping, you know, create some of the platforms that eventually emerged and acknowledging those contributions as well. So, that was part of what it was. And there are some things that, you know, began to, you know, transform so quickly that it kind of, you know, took my breath away. I'm just thinking, I was part of the conversation that led to the funding that the funding commitment that the UUA made to Black Lives of Unitarian Universalism. And it's like, oh, okay, well, this is, so it just gave me a sense, you know, at that point of just the potential, you know, of the moment. And maybe this is a moment in time where I can leverage my influence in a way that's useful.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you for running. I'm just so excited for you.
Thank you.
For all of us.
Thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity to be on The View and appreciate what you all are doing and appreciate you all as colleagues in this work that we're doing together, which is to build a world in which there's room and enough for all of us.
And, you know, I want to reiterate that despite my bringing up those statistics, I believe in you and I believe in your ability to articulate the positive values that people are really looking for.
Thank you, Michael.
I thought it was worth mentioning those things. But
well, Michael, I think you showed like Carlton's courage by lifting up those statistics. That's what I heard about it. Like that Carlton could see those and see something beyond them that takes vision to see.
Yeah, I mean, and again, I mean, if we're looking at Dr. King's legacy, he wasn't wildly popular at the time. He's got a holiday now, yeah, sure, and there's a big statue on the mall in Washington. But at the time, it's like he was very controversial and not universally loved or liked, and he kept on anyway. So I think, you know, part of what my contribution is to honoring his legacy is being willing to hold true to my vision and what I think is even a shared vision for what's possible, and to maintain focus on that and to live into that rather than to being wedded to things as they are now.
Well, thanks so much for joining us. Anything you didn't get to say you'd like to?
Can I just say, if people want to know more about the campaign, they're welcome to go to carltonforcongress.com. That's the website. And I'm also on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram as well. And all that information is available too.
Well, this is very inspiring. I'm lifted up to go into my day. Thank you so much for those of you who came. Podcast will be up soon. If you're listening to this, it already is. Thanks to Terry Bernor, who's been hiding behind the chalice today.
Thanks, Terry.
And we will see you next time.
This has been an episode of The View. If you would like to learn more about the CLF, visit questformeaning.org.